Y'all had such good ideas earlier. Let me ask you this. I'm going to talk a little bit about, again, about that position of giving to other people. Let me ask you, somebody was telling me earlier about feeling kind of burned out and, overwhelmed. Somebody was telling me about dealing with a death kind of event in their family. If I come to you, no. Switch that. If you come to me and you are burdened and you want to talk about a place where you're hurting there, an anxiety you have or a habitual sin in your life, or I'm struggling with this loss, what is it that you want from me? Empathy. What would you like? Empathy. What would empathy give you? What is empathy? Good. Empathy is different than sympathy, because sympathy is how I feel. Oh, I feel so sorry about that. Empathy is like being a method actor.
Yeah.
It's feeling the pain.
In other words, okay, I'm Al Pacino, and I'm going to play a gangster. What's it like to be a gangster? Get into their mind. Empathy means you're telling me I've lost the third person in my family in a year and a half, and I'm going to try that on and go, whoa. You know what? 36 years ago today, my brother died. This is the 21st. Okay, we'll talk about sadness in a minute. What got me to that? What reminded me of that? I was pretending to talk to somebody who had felt with death, and I thought about death. Do I have a reference point? Somebody talked about shared experience. We all have a shared experience of pain we don't know what to do with. Empathy is, I'm going to be with you. That's a huge way to be with. What else do you need from me if you bring your heart where you're hurting? What do you want to receive?
Compassion,
yes. I get it. I do the empathy, and you see that it moves me. I care about it. What else?
A hug.
A hug is the physical version of deep connection. You want to be connected with somebody. Notice nobody has said truth yet, and that's a good thing. We're about to get to truth, and I was jabbing y'all a little bit about the truth thing earlier, but it's on purpose that we haven't gotten to truth yet. But what I was just playing with y'all was a game I play all the time in my work. And that is, let's say somebody's coming to you and wants to bring their heart to you, and you feel that need to fix, and they need to walk away going, ooh, Jimmy is such a life-giving guy, and you feel a need to fix. What actually should you say? Somebody brings their heart, here's how I struggle, this has been hurting me, and you are listening, and you're trying it on, and you're doing that curiosity. And one of the things I love to say is simply this: how can I give to you there? What do you need? A, you're off the hook. Because everybody feels like you've got to come up with what they need, right? You don't. Let them help you. Saying what do you need recognizes for both of you that you're not a mind reader. It also says I'm kind of open to where you need to go. A lot of times people will tell me nothing. I just need to tell somebody. All right. Mischief managed. Okay. The other thing that question does that I like is it reminds people that even though I am here on your behalf to give to you, that ultimately the stewardship of what your growth is going to look like does belong to you. What do I need? A lot of us who want to help other people can go real quickly into, okay, well, I need to come up with, what are the points that we're... Okay. This is their heart, their life. That's some of that emotional boundary we need to not get burned out in giving to people. But another thing that asking what you need does is Most people have never thought about it. The number one answer, what do you think is the number one answer I get when I say to somebody, whoa, wow, how can I give to you there? What do you need? What do they say? I don't know. Exactly. Now, what just happened psychologically is they're bringing all this pain or they're bringing all this hurt. They're back there in their little amygdala, in their little midbrain, feeling this pain, feeling kind of overwhelmed. And I just asked them a question after connecting with them and being with them, and it went zoomp to their frontal lobes. And they're like, I don't know. All right, now we're hauling the mail. All right, now we got them thinking, let's think together, what could it be that you need? All right, that's actually a very helpful question. I even do that in the office all the time. I mean, I would assume that if somebody gets out of bed and comes all the way downtown to my office and pays me a bunch of money, they're going to want my advice. But just this week, I was thinking about this talk, and I heard myself say this. I said, this person was talking about this big problem, and I said, I actually have a couple of thoughts about it. Do you want them? I ask at the office, and it's pretty obvious at the office that they do want them, but I still ask. I just think it's good manners. But I still, it also says, are you ready for a question about moving forward? Do you just need to sit in this place? See, I'm oriented toward that connection with them, but it does get them to start going, I don't know, and they'll go, I guess I need some thoughts, and they will start actually processing it. And you're getting them to help themselves, all right? Now, the truth. The reason that we're just now talking about truth is because our focus has been so much on repentant people rather than unrepentant. And just to continue clarifying that, I don't mean to create an us versus them kind of, you know, they're an unrepentant. I just encounter in my work all the time people who don't care about growth and they don't care that they hurt people. And they don't have that experience of like, I can be kind of mean and that's not a good thing. There is a category of those kind of people, all right? And that's what I mean. Like I said last night, we're all unrepentant about something. But with people who are struggling and humble and want to grow, repentant people, we don't lead with truth. We're just now getting to truth. And why is that? I mean, truth should be easy. We all want truth, right? I mean, people pay lots of money to learn the true way to invest their money or to play tennis better or to make chicken risotto. You know, we want to learn the true way to make things. But somehow, if you bring the truth, it often feels bad to us. And it's because of this. And this is why we're going in this order with repentant people. Truth that's not given with the anesthesia of grace always feels like judgment, especially unsolicited advice. That's the deal breaker, baby. That's another reason we're going to ask, what do you need? What can I give you? I have some thoughts. Are you interested? Never give unsolicited advice unless somebody's directly hurting you. I mean, if they're like harming you in your home, don't ask their permission to say stop, all right? But with any other context, we're going to ask permission for truth, and we're going to give it in the anesthesia of grace because our hearts are broken. Part of the fall, part of what's broken in us in the fall is, ooh, remind me, let's talk about sin later on. I have a little experience with it, so I'll have to sort of spitball it, but, you know. One of the things that's bent in us is that truth, which should be our friend, truth, which is a gift. You know, Paul talks in Romans about the gift that the Jews had because they had the law. They had the way that God created things. This was this gift for them. We hate truth, you know, unless it benefits us. Something in us is broken. We should want it. But we have to have it now that we're broken. We have to have it with the anesthesia of truth. So, how do we give truth? Number one, I've already said it. Ask permission to give truth when at all possible. I've got some thoughts. Here they are. Would you like them? Number two, I like to give truth like a mirror. If you're thinking about telling somebody the hard truth, this is kind of something you're doing, and it's kind of hurting people or hurting me, or being creating something destructive in your life, give it like a mirror. How does a mirror give truth? Just the facts, ma'am. Yeah. A mirror doesn't have any evaluation. A mirror doesn't even tell you you ought not to. A mirror just says, there's a piece of spinach on your tail. All right? That's what a mirror does. Now, you can leave it there if you want. And James would say you're a fool if you look in the mirror and turn away. But a mirror brings truth in a way that's not condemning. I want to say to someone who's talking to me about this person in their life, they can't stand that person, and they're obsessed with them. And as I hear them or connect with them or walk our first steps of kind of understanding them, I'm going to say, I have some thoughts about this. You know, you're giving this person so much power in your life. Like, they're kind of defining you. And so it might be cool to start asking, what is it in you that is letting them own this part of you that they hurt? Now, here, I just told them the truth. But it wasn't judgmental or demanding or whatever. I'm bringing it like a mirror. This is hurting you. My safe friend, partner at work, we have a mutual friend who tends to be a real kind of judgy, real theologically kind of guy. And they were talking about a mutual friend. And the judgy guy goes, I don't hear from, you know, Robert anymore. I contact me, he's kind of ghosted me and left and whatever. And my partner, who's a pretty frank fella, he goes, well, I mean, I got a thought. Why? And the judgy guy goes, okay, what? He said, I think he's afraid you'll judge him because you can be a little judgy. I love that. And the guy said, I do kind of come across that way sometimes. I mean, it got him. He had the anesthesia of knowing that Jim loved him, and he told him the truth, okay? Picking up on that, I love to bring truth as reality versus morality. We're not saying the morality does not exist, but since we are wounded with judgment and shame, our ears hear judgment so much and so readily, and judgment and shame will make us go where? Hiding in a way. That we, if we can deliver truth more as reality than morality, we're like hedging our bets 90% that they're going to be more able and willing to hear it. Okay? I mean, sometimes we make God's way, his law, too religious. All right? Like, don't do that. That's wrong. But if you look at his word, it's almost more, it's like not like he's saying, you're bad. It's almost like, don't eat soap. And we're like, well, I'll eat soap if I want to, you know? And then what is he always saying? Do this that you may live. Don't do that or you will die. He's not going, don't do that or I'll be real mad and you'll be a bad boy. He says, that'll kill you. In other words, so much of God's law really is presented in a reality way. And I want to bring it to people in a way that they are able to hear and metabolize better. I was talking to a client this week, and he was talking about his relationship with his wife, and he had lots of good points. She is a kind of neurotic little girl, and I'm listening to him talk, but as I'm listening to him, I'm realizing this guy is ticked. And I listen, and I'm like, wow, wow, she does that too, wow, wow. And these are problems. I know her. And we've met together, and some work we need to do. But the more he talked, the more I felt like, well, I'll tell you what I said to him. I said, I see these things that you're doing, that she's doing. But there's a vibe I'm kind of feeling. Can I tell you about it? And he said, yeah. I said, the way you talk about it and the way you quote yourself talking to her feels like an angry parent. Like, I can't believe that you would do. And I think that actually inclines her to be even more immature. And he's like, I really think I do come across that way. I'm like, yeah. I actually had a conflict with a friend years back who was a therapist. Therapist friends are an interesting breed. I was mad at this person, and I was carrying on, and I was kind of, you know, snappy and all this, and they stopped me, and they said, John, I actually do want to give you what you're asking for, but the way you're acting right now is actually making it harder for me to give it to you. I'm like, okay. Like the big mouth frog, oh, it's our soul. Okay.
You were a therapist, too.
Yeah, right. Also, a different kind of truth is limits. If you want to talk more about unrepentant people, limits are a form of truth. And as I've said, with unrepentant people, we often need to lead with limits. In other words, somebody's doing something destructive. Loving them more, being kinder to them more, will make them worse. They need somebody to say, if you're, you know, this is an example in the difficult people talk. You know, somebody comes marching in the door and they're like, what are you thinking parking like that? And that's their kind of go-to style. Now, what the victim people will often do is say, I can't believe they talked to me like that. But when they walk in the door going, what are you thinking parking like that? They'll go, well, I thought you wanted to get out the garbage later. In other words, they're play along. I see these people all the time in my office. And I'm like, the reason that they continue to treat you like this is because you're participating. I want you to say, whoa, I don't think I want to have a conversation that starts like that. If you want to talk about the parking thing, let's do a do-over. But I'm not going to do the, what are you thinking, kind of dressing down. Let's try a different way. And usually these people escalate a little bit after that. But the point of the difficult people talk and the engagement with unrepentant people is you'll be treated as poorly as you permit. All right? And if they say, what are you thinking, parking like that, and you lead with empathy or understanding or humility, well, I know I don't park well, and you play under them, that's you're co-signing the note. You're giving them permission. I will let you talk to me like this because, see, I will respond to you. I want you to think about what it means to set limits with them. Listen to difficult people talk. We can ask questions more later on. By the way, let's talk about this as we talk about limits with repentant people. We alluded to this last night, and it's super important because we were talking about out-of-control behaviors. What do you do with an out-of-control behavior in your life? Maybe it's eating, maybe it's screaming and raging, maybe it's just inappropriate, sinful kind of habitual stuff. You have out-of-control behavior in your life, and you are repentant. You're Romans 7. You want to stop. What do you need? What do you do with that? All right, that fits into the truth and limits category. We need two things if we're going to address an out-of-control behavior. Number one, we need some understanding in a relationship with someone else. We need some engagement with the why, the little square. In other words, what is driving this behavior? Remember my bulimic client from last night? Food will always be my friend. One of the things we've got to address with her is, why is food your friend? Why don't you have other friends? What scares you about friends? What is your heart needing? What are you longing for? What emptiness are you trying to fill up? We've got to address that. But if that's all you do, you'll have a very nurtured and insightful bulimic or rageaholic who's really like in tune with their inner world and acting like a maniac, okay? So you got to have the second one, and that is you need to have literal experiential, remember experience is where we learn, limits and consequences for the behavior. Something has to happen to you. Now, you can do switcheroo, which starts first, but you need both of these. All right, if you never look at the why, then you're painting over the rusty charcoal grill like we talked about last night. But if you only look at the why, you get a lot of insight and a lot of misbehavior. So you got to have a cost. In other words, it needs to literally cost you in reality. Now, let me tell you why. It's because the part of us that's acting out is like a little square. He's like 5 years old, all right? And telling him, you know, you really ought to quit yelling at your wife. That's a bad thing to do. He doesn't know that. He's a concrete thinker. He's 5 years old. Doesn't mean anything to him. That's like telling your eighth grader, it's like, go upstairs and do your homework, because just think of all the people you'll help one day as a neurosurgeon. He's like, what? Okay? You need to take his Xbox away, okay? He's a concrete thinker. He needs experience. In other words, we need to treat the little parts of us with discipline and limits like we do little kids. You need an event, all right? I have a guy who I saw a while back who was struggling with porn, and we kept trying to find a consequence for him. What we came up with was we were looking at all the dynamics that were driving his compulsion, and we were doing cool work with that. But if he used, he had to give me $100, which I used to help pay for therapy for people who couldn't afford it, okay? And every now and then he'd just walk in the office and walk by my desk and slap $100 on it, you know, and go sit on the couch, and I'd file it away, you know? But it was like there was a literal experience there. Did I tell y'all at the other conferences about my man cave? Losing my man cave? Not enough nods, so I'll tell you again. This is how I use it on me. I guess this was probably 5-6 years ago. We went through this. I have a great man cave, all right? Like, we had three girls. The whole upstairs was theirs. They're all gone. I turned the playroom into, like, it's got, like, guns in it and a big TV and movie posters. It's cool. So I love my man cave. So we went through this season where Norman and I would get in, like, a little tiff. And I'd go upstairs and watch a movie or something like that. And I'd come back down to go to bed about, you know, 10 o'clock and walk in the room. And I'd be like, and another thing. You know what else? And it's like, all of a sudden, I'm going off on her again about this thing we were fighting about 3 hours ago. And she's like under the covers in her jammies, you know. And the next morning, she said, that felt horrible. I mean, I didn't sleep good. You come in this like scary man. And I'm like, you know, you're really right. That was bad. I'm not going to do that again. And about 3 weeks later, I did it again. And she said, you did it again. I'm like, I did it again. Well, I'm a psychologist and I know this stuff. And I said, okay, here's the deal. I was still, it must have been longer than 5-6 years ago because I was still in therapy. So I started digging as to what was going on about what was going on with my anger, but I said, next time I do that, I lose the man cave for a week. I'm down here with you watching Grey's Anatomy. If that doesn't teach you, man, me and Norma and Dr. McDreamy, it's like, anyway, a couple of weeks later, I did it again, and Norma says, man cave. And I lost it for a week. And I haven't done it since. And you might say, well, does that mean you love your man cave more than Norma? Because you wouldn't stop just for Norma, but you would for losing your man cave. No. The guy who's yelling at her, he isn't married. He's 5 years old. Okay? He needs a literal experience. So limits, truth, understanding, start to love and limits. So we talked about slight, start to weave really well in that place of out-of-control behavior. All right, let me wrap up, and then we can do questions and discussion and all that you want. And I want to wrap up by talking about sadness. Because the goal of all of this if you want to go way back, as y'all have learned by now, I like big pictures. The goal of all growth in God's universe, I think, is to receive that which we're missing, to fill up those empty places, to be in a process of growth, to do all the stuff that we've talked about all weekend. And in the background of all of that, and in the background of all of our lives, and in the background of creation now that it has fallen, the goal is twofold: to receive what we can in order to grow, to be becoming more whole, more Christ-like, and to develop the ability to grieve that which will not change the side of glory. My job is the world of emotion. I can tell you about emotion like a car salesman can tell you about a car. Now, this is your Ford F-150. Now, that's got a supercharger in it, and it's four-wheel drive. Now, this one over here, and he can tell you all about him. That's me and emotion. And one of the most interesting emotions I've stumbled across, I kind of found it as I was in my practice, in my life, in my own therapy, was sadness. It's different from all the other emotions. And we don't talk about it really, but I want to bring it back up to discourage it. Like, oh, don't be sad. But I want to bring it back into vogue. Because sadness is different from any other emotion, and I want you to have this category. In the context of all of our brokenness, all of our little squares, all of the dynamics of what it looks like to grow and receive, to have the category of what sadness and grief is and how vital it is. And here's why. Because sadness, for some reason, is a progressive emotion. It is a transitional emotion. All right? In other words, you can be depressed forever. And you can be angry forever. And you can be anxious forever. But if you feel sadness, if you let go and let yourself look at how much this hurts, the truth of this injury, with somebody else, grieving alone is an oxymoron, looking at the truth of that, you will probably cry, but you will move. You will move from one place to another. I think it's a gift that God gave us. I think God invented sadness and threw it out the door at Eden, like, you're going to need this if you're going to deal with that world. If you feel sad, you will move. I just mentioned my brother's death. I felt moved when I touched it. But if this was, let's give me a year, 35 years ago, I wouldn't be able to talk about it. I'd start crying. Now, does that mean I love him less? Does that mean I miss him less? Not a chance. So what's the difference? I don't know. If you grieve somehow, the loss feels like this, which is the sweet warmth about my brother. Not that jagged piece of glass it used to be. And this sort of sense of something loving, which I'll talk about in just a minute. But this is one of the reasons the Bible talks so much about grief. Think about it. The Bible talks about grieving and being sad all the time. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Well, actually, you could flip that around. You're not going to ever be comforted until you mourn. Psalm 128, he who goes forth weeping, scattering seeds of sorrow, will come back in the morning leaping with sheaves of joy. The Bible is always talking about that dynamic. The whole theme of the Psalms of Lament. The Bible and me want you to to get the sense of how much sadness is not just a bad feeling like all the other ones. Oh, don't be sad. But sadness is a tool. It is operational. It is utilitarian. And here's the key. It doesn't just apply to death. It applies to all stuff, all of our losses. All right? Who was it who asked me the loss question last night? Are you back? Yeah. What do we do when we face loss? We said last night, we protest it, we get angry, we can get depressed. We said, pick a card, any card. We engage loss and we immediately go to war against it. Anger is a secondary, is what I call a defensive emotion. Anger is a secondary emotion. Anger is the second thing we feel. In other words, if you're angry, you're trying not to feel something vulnerable. Think about it. Your wife tells an embarrassing story about you at a party. You get in the car, first thing you say is, what do you think you're telling that story about me? You're mad, right? What did you feel right before that? You were really embarrassed, okay? You're on the way to a job interview. You miss every light. You top the hill and it changes yellow and you go, ah! You're mad, right? What did you feel right before that? Helpless, scared you'll be late, vulnerable. Behind anger is almost always something vulnerable. People who come to me with anger problems, they actually probably have a I can't metabolize loss problem, all right? We do anything to not deal with loss. And of course, God calls us to engage our growth and our pain. That's why I spent an entire weekend talking about that. But at the end of the day, he calls us to grieve well. Can I be sad about how that person hurt me? That hurt me and it cost me and it took from me and I still feel the cost. And can I grieve that and can we grieve together about how someone might have hurt us? Rather than living in anger or retaliation against them. Can I be sad that my spouse doesn't get it? Or do I need to escalate? I used to tell Norma that I don't get mean until the seventh time you don't hear me. Like the sixth time, I'm like, no, that's actually not what I'm saying. And the seventh time, I'm like, for crying out loud. You know, it's like, I gave you seven chances. This almost sounds biblical. But sadness is how we actually metabolize loss and pain rather than escaping it or protesting it. It feels like a letting go. It feels like a giving up. When I first learned to feel sadness, I called it happy hopelessness. Because it was like, you know, no matter what I do, my dad is never going to have treated me this way that I needed. That's hopeless. But God, there's kind of a freedom in just crying about that, giving that up. There's this hope for that. In a sense, a lot of the goal of growth, a lot of the goal of getting beyond our psychopathology, our symptoms, our hurtfulness, is developing the ability to be sad instead of protesting or angry or withdrawing, okay? And one more level, if you turn from sin, you will be sad. In fact, you can't turn from sin unless you get sad. As I said, we can talk more about sin. I mentioned last night, so much sin is about taking. I don't want to have to do without. I'm going to take. And if you start saying no to your impulses or your desire to retaliate or gossip about that person or, you know, engage in that sin again, whatever, if you say no to that, it's going to hurt. But that hurt is not just pain. I want it to be sadness. Remaining in our place as God's creations will be sad. That's why we are blessed there. If Adam and Eve had been sad, we wouldn't be sitting here today. They would have said, oh, gee whiz, that fruit looks delightful to the eyes and profitable to make one wise. I want it so bad. Me too, babe. And that snake, he seems nice. I'm so sad we can't have that fruit. We're not going to mention the fact that we have every other tree in the garden, but that fruit looks really, this is really sad. If you're sad, you won't get that vengeance or control or lust. You'll be sad. If you push back on your sin, you will be sad. You will grieve. If you really live pushing back on your sin, you could even be called a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. Because that is what it's like to live God's way. And I don't want that just to feel like a deprivation, grit your teeth, a torment. It will be sad. You will engage a feeling that is a gift that God gives us that says, join me in sorrow. And let that sorrow heal the parts of you that, the parts of all of us that so go without, that so live without. And that be sad. One of the reasons it works, I think, is because sadness, anatomically speaking, at the atomic molecular level, sadness is so close to love. Sadness, if I feel sadness, I'm feeling sort of a self-compassion. You know, if you sit down next to somebody who's lost a loved one, and you just kind of sit down next to them and you put your arm around them, like we said earlier in that silence at the funeral, and you just go, man, this hurts. Sadness is sort of like doing that with your own heart. It's like saying, this hurts. I call it feeling sorrow for yourself, right? Which is very different from feeling sorry for yourself. People go, you shouldn't feel that. It's feeling sorry for yourself. No, feeling sorry for yourself, like Eeyore. You know, what does Eeyore say? Stuff like that. That's not sadness. That's passive-aggressive jab. He's saying, Piglet, I hate you. You know, okay? We're not talking about that. You need to feel real bad. You know, that's feeling sorry for yourself. It's gotten a bad name. This is feeling sorrow for yourself. And it is a form of love. Compassion is a form of love, and love is what heals us. Hello. Get it? What's that Jim Elliot quote? He is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. Sadness. Let's talk about it. Let's do questions. I'll check the phone. Let's go back to what we're talking about being heard or empathy or truth or whatever y'all need. There are a lot of good questions on here. I want to start with one local first, if you have one. Yes. When does sadness become unhealthy? What does unhealthy look like?
Just being sad all the time, not getting over it. I can talk. I mean, not feeling like you're not getting over it, over whatever is grieving you.
All right, a couple of questions I would ask are, is it really sadness? Because sadness can masquerade as depression a lot, like we said last night. If I am feeling that mopey kind of lost feeling, that might not be sadness, all right? So one of the things I want to check out in a relationship is how much of this is a literal grieving where I feel myself in that place of compassion about my pain, and how much of this is something in me that's feeling just dark because I've kind of shut something down because it hurts so much. All right. Secondly, before I would give up any hope that the sadness is quote unquote working or not, I would want to really double check in that I am doing that sadness in relationship. All right. Because sadness, grieving alone is an oxymoron, I said. I want to cry with somebody if I'm feeling stuck in that. I would always check that first. And then I would check how much of it is real sadness. Defining exactly what sadness looks like It's almost like you got to feel it. It's hard to describe it. I'll try more to describe it if you want. But those are some thoughts. Can you speak into walking with someone into community through a hard season and needing to take a step back and heal after that? Maybe about how to set boundaries to allow yourself time to refuel and heal. Great question. Someone alluded to that last night. Someone asked me about that some this morning. And that is, it's a funny role when you feel like you can actually give to people, because you will have to not sometimes. There are two or three of y'all last night. Remember, I stopped us last night by going, I need to stop. I'm kind of woozy. Remember? And about two or three of y'all came up to me afterwards with questions. And with each of you, I said, dude, I got to like ask you a favor. I'm like, my brain isn't really working. And I felt so sad about that later. I felt sad. Like, I wanted to be able to give to those people, and I couldn't. So remember last night we were talking about how do you find the needle, the gas needle, all right? How do you find room? You need permission. I mean, even Jesus went and got in the boat at some point, like, paddle me away from these people, right? And if you're going to be in a giving position, you better be a good steward of your gas tank. I tell clients who are overgivers, I'm like, this is your life, is you're the Exxon truck that drives around to all the gas stations and fills them up with gas, and you're running out of gas on the side of the road. There's an irony there. You know, you used to have 80,000 gallons of gas, and now you're running out of gas yourself. I want you to have the permission to do it and find the safe people who can give to you. So that, drawing that line, like I say, I have to learn kind of trial and error. That's the word I'm looking for. Because I'll realize, ooh, I'm giving too much, and I'll have to dial back a little. Anybody else here? Yes.
Making it about you.
How can you express empathy without making it about you? Can you give me an example of like what making empathy about me would sound like? Are you willing to go further?
Like being able to say me too, but not doing that in a skillful way where the focus is still giving the other person the emphasis.
That's cool.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. All right. We talked last night about how Me Too is even a healing thing with shame. And Me Too says sort of you're not alone. This is not a weird, isolated problem that just you have. I can kind of join that, okay? That is a healing thing. Let's make a distinction between Me Too and I get you.
Yes.
All right? In other words, I wouldn't go to a Me Too unless they asked for it. And if I said, what do you need? And one of their things was, I mean, have you ever felt this, like you committed the unpardonable sin? I go, absolutely. All right. So there's room for the Me Too. I want them to kind of ask me for this. The get you part, remember I was saying that, how does the saying go? It's my saying. I ought to know it. The feeling of being gotten and understood is so close to the feeling of being loved that they're almost indistinguishable, right? Empathy is, I'm going to talk to you about you. Yeah. So what it would sound like is this. Wait a minute. So you're telling me that your mom made it really clear that it was important to you that you celebrate her birthday. And you got a cake and you made her dinner. And she walks in the house and the first thing she says is, I don't like chocolate cake. That's the first thing she says? And they'll go, yeah. And I go, I would probably ask, what was that like? Because I want them to go in. But the empathy piece was, that must have felt like everything you tried to create just got stomped on. And they will go, yes.
So you're mirroring back to them, like, what they're saying, not in a like formulaic way.
Right.
Instead of going, yeah, my mom was really
messed
up
that
too.
That would be making it about you.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
All right.
That's
so
great.
During is a as I tell spouses this all the time. They're like, okay, I understand. And I'm like, don't tell her you understand, show her you understand. And that means say, so for you, when I come in late every night when you've made supper, it's almost like I don't care about how hard you've worked. And she'll go, yes. All right. Empathy is an engagement that I'm taking it in, trying it on, reflecting on it, and giving it back to you in a way where you see that you are gotten. There's something about that in itself that's incredibly healing. That you get me thing really makes a connection. And for some reason, I don't understand, connection and being understood is healing in itself. All right. Let me do a phoner. So many of you all wrote in. Ooh, this is a good one. No, I didn't answer this. Is it okay to use church community to grow and heal from heart if your spouse won't, quote unquote, meet your heart needs? Is it wrong to seek community outside when there isn't the connection in the marriage? I did kind of speak to that, though, didn't I? The theme of both of my marriage conferences, in a sense, is this. Marriages will default to two ticks and no dog. I need to be understood, and you're the one to do it. And that's behind most fights in marriages, is why don't you give me this thing, all right? Now, what that looks like is I've got kind of half a lunchbox, but I'm kind of hoping you'll fill it up the rest of the way. But you only have half a lunchbox, and you're kind of hoping I'm going to fill it up the rest of the way. And so, of course, we fall in love and get married, and now I'm like, let the fulfillment begin, baby. Fill my lunchbox up the rest of the way. And she's like, what? I thought you were supposed to fill up my lunchbox. And besides, if I give you the half, it's filled, I'm going to be empty. I won't have anything. And most marriage problems are because I need you. It's like I've told y'all in the marriage conference that normally I used to have the whose day was worse war. It's like I'll come in mopey because I've worked so hard providing for the family, you know. But the source of my adoration is slumped over the stove cooking something I don't like for dinner, you know. And I'm like, hey. And she's like, hey, as if to say, welcome home from your 8-hour vacation, you know. Now, I don't know about her, but I've been helping people all day, okay? And she's like, well, at least you've had adult conversation that has some meaning in your life. I've just had, like, throw up all over me, you know, and been in the pediatrician's the sick part, you know, the gross part, you know. And we have this, which one of us is going to matter, all right? Because we both have these, half-empty lunch boxes. And understand that that's going on in the background of your marriage. Who's going to get their needs met is behind this person's question. It's also the talk, getting the baggage out of your marriage. Listen to it on the podcast. So your question, whoever you are, is right on spot, and that is, I never talk about marriage in a conference, that I don't talk about this, what we're doing this weekend, even at a little level. You want a better marriage? Build better church community. In other words, God did not make marriage. It's a romantic relationship. It's not a developmental relationship. It's not designed to meet these needs. God wants marriage to be the fruit of our fulfillment, not the source of it. The body of Christ is the source of it. If you want a better marriage, don't go to get a marriage book or go to a John Cox seminar or whatever like that. Be building deeper relationships and filling up your own picnic basket, lunch basket, and in your own growth and relationships. And what happens is if couples invest in relationships outside of each other, they stop being two ticks and no dog, and they start being people who have, you know, I have a pretty good picnic basket, and so I'm going to ask you to go on a picnic. And if we do, that'd be great. We can have a picnic together. And if you don't, I'm okay. I got a picnic basket. I'm not going to die. All right? And it takes that intensity down. All right? So, yes. That was about four different metaphors, but I think y'all stay with me. We got a picnic basket, we got ticks, we got... Anyway, sorry. But yes, the answer to your question, yes. Fill yourself up in relationships. Here's why this is so important, Body of Christ stuff, right?
Okay.
Notice the Bible talks a lot more about oneness in the body than it talks about oneness in romantic relationship. Okay? And we might, we turn marriage into this special little place. Y'all need some cute couple time. You know, we need to get you a wife. Like, that's going to answer everybody's problems. You know, it's no wonder we're all disappointed. And it's no wonder the singles are freaking out, going, what if I never get married? I'll miss out on the font of wonder. You know, but the Bible talks a lot more about richness within the body than it does, like, being one and married. Go ahead.
Okay, so if we want to jumpstart intimacy with friendships that we already have.
Yes.
But they, you know. Yeah, we just need some help with that. Yeah. What would you suggest? Like, how do we make that happen? Can you point me in some questions, you know, that we mm-hmm. could dive into better intimacy together?
Oh, yeah. That's fine. It's kind of like dating. You know, you ask questions, you learn. So what's your career aspirations? You know, it's like, well, I ultimately want to lace shoes for a living. And you're like, okay, maybe not. Start with this. I went to this interesting conference this weekend. And these are just talking about relationships and going deeper and how we often don't go deeper. It was kind of cool. I mean, your church ever do stuff like that? And if they go, no. But if they say, no, but I kind of wish they would, what do you say? All right, you're already opening up something, okay? I try, like my examples earlier, trying a little bit more honesty. Like, I know you're supposed to, like, love your kids or anything like that, but sometimes it's like when I finally get them down, it's like I just want to medicate them, you know, till day after tomorrow. You know, try on something real and see how they respond. I want to start baiting people with reality. And if they respond back, we start going deeper. More honesty, more vulnerability. Now, I only want to give enough to where if they blow me off, it's not going to hurt me. But that's just why I start little. Is that answering your question?
Yeah, I feel like maybe even more. Like, you know, we're already there. We can relate on the fact that we want to medicate our children. But, like, what's, like, the next step? Because we could talk about our children for hours. Like, the problem is we got to get past that. You know, we got to get past, like, the jobs and the kids. And we got to, like, get to, like,
all right,
hearts.
All right, so I wish I could say, what do you wish you could talk about? I don't want to put you on the spot like that.
I honestly don't know.
All right, well, then I'll make up one for me. All right, so I'm thinking about a friend who I have an okay relationship with, but wish I could go deeper. I'm going to think, I'll tell them about this weekend. I'll say, can I tell you about what I did this weekend? I'm interested in how open they are to that. I'm like, yeah. Okay. You passed the first test. I'm going to say, they asked me to do this conference I've never done before. And I really kind of had to dig into my thinking about how growth works and put it in language that was approachable. And it was really kind of scary. Like, I was so relieved on Friday night that it kind of worked, that I actually told the crowd, I'm so relieved that it worked. But I was really kind of anxious about it. I don't know. I just want to tell you about it. It turned out okay, but it scared me. See, I just gave a little more of my heart. Now, I'm very interested in what they do with that. Why are you worried about that, man? You're the bomb. I go, I don't always feel like the bomb. I wonder what they're going to do with that. Well, I know what you mean. Neither do I. All right, now we're off the races. All right, so I'm going to bring in a little more of me. Is that getting closer to your question?
Yeah.
I'm bringing a little more of my heart. Now, if they go, you're an idiot. You're a great psychologist. Quit worrying about these people. I'm like, okay, well, let's get some fries. I'm like, okay, we're not going to be besties. All right. But I can try just with more of my heart. Just bring it. Also, you've heard of a downward spiral. There's an upward spiral here. As I get more grounded in me, in who I am, that individuation we were talking about on the other side of this board, that whatever you think about me, that's not going to terrify me or make me have to shift or hedge or not be who I am with you. The more grounded I get, the more strong I am and the less afraid I am to take more risk with you and be more open with you, so I actually develop more close relationships and you have an upward spiral. So be aware as you're thinking about that, why do I give people so much power? So this guy goes, dude, you talk like a shrink, you're an idiot with all your anxiety stuff, and he's really unkind to me. Am I strong enough to kind of go, okay, I took a shot at it, strike three, he's out, and not let it go, oh, I feel so ashamed, I shouldn't have said that. The more me there is, the more risk I can take, and the more I can develop those relationships.
John?
Mm-hmm.
I think you may cover this on the Difficult People podcast, but what if someone at church is doing this with a roommate or a coworker, but someone at church or a spouse, and they just are—they're probably the unrepentant, and that they are not—they're not responding, and you feel like somehow that's not right if you're both in church, like if you can't, you know, look at somebody in the face, or if your husband or wife is not responding to you kindly, saying what you just said about the parking, it just doesn't seem to get better. It's just not helping.
All right, so keep the mic.
Okay.
I want to understand your question better. These are people who have relationships and with other people, and there's a dynamic with that person that's hurtful. And they keep trying to address it, and it doesn't get any better. And what's the next part?
The part that makes it different is I have to live with this person.
Married?
As in married or in church or in my job. Like, I cannot say, you're dead to me.
Right, I'm out.
So I need to find a way to love and forgive and all that stuff, but it may not look like we're doing the dance on Friday night, you know? So I don't know if that tracks.
The dance?
You know, talking, having fun.
Okay.
You know, being normal. Like, there is a chasm. They're not looking at you, or you're withdrawing from your spouse because you keep on trying and they keep on not getting it. You have a friend that you've, what Lauren was saying last night, that just you do all the things you're telling us to do, and we're still where we were when we started.
Yes.
And kind of how long, you know? Or what if you're like, oh my goodness, I'm getting further and further away. Like, I remember on your podcast, you said, you know, when you do that to me, I just withdraw. And that's the experience you want that person to know. I don't know if I'm making sense at all.
Okay, it's getting there. I'll try to make an answer that has the same amount of sense to it. So,
well, thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Back at you, babe.
There you go. I've been up early, folks.
All right. All right, a couple of things I want to clarify. One of them was a marriage, and you can't just dump that unless it's just you've tried everything and this is just a destructive relationship. So in that sense, stuck. Someone you're working with, you can't make the boss fire them, so you're kind of stuck. Someone in the church, you're going to have interaction with them, cross paths with them. So you're talking about dynamics with relationships in which you need to continue interacting. Okay? And some of your question, in a sense, is what do I do with my own heart and my own feelings, or how miserable it is, or how difficult it is to be around them, given that they're like this, right?
That, and am I doing what God asked me to when it says forgive 7 times 7 or Matthew 18 or all that stuff? What if I've done all that? There's this expectation of somehow this will work out, and when it doesn't, where do I take my heart?
All right.
Because I'm uncomfortable in that.
Let me play with this a little bit along the lines of the Difficult People podcast. Because if this is somebody who chronically is being hurtful, and I'm going to want to say to them, this is chronically hurtful. And hey, man, it might be partly me, but are you willing to look at the part that's partly you and us work this out? Because this is pulling me further away from you. And when I gave that example in that talk, that was a woman who was using that phrase as a redemptive tool to show her husband the impact, the cost of what he was doing. When you treat me that way, I feel something in me pulling away, almost like I wish it wouldn't, okay? So I'm coming to that person and I'm saying, I want to change, and they're basically like, would you get over it? All right, that person is what I mean by an unrepentant style. And at that level, this is what I was telling y'all last night. What current day Christianity has done is kind of tells us to treat everybody like they're repentant. You should go Matthew 18 with them. You know, Matthew 18, you go the kind of the hierarchy, talk to the person, bring a friend to talk to the person, bring the elders to talk to the person. Otherwise, treat them like a Gentile or an IRS agent. It's just that time of year, I'm sorry. Or turn the other cheek, or love keeps no record of wrongs, or Jesus is only gentle and lowly, or it's all of it. It's like what they need is this sort of tender engagement, which I kept running up against in my office, because if you treat hurtful and repentant people that way, they get worse. So step one is to realize, I told a guy the other day, I was talking to him about, his wife is just like a petulant child. And we were talking about limit setting on the way she treats him. And he was talking about grieving the loss of the marriage that he wanted. And he says, just so sad to me, because I see other couples and they get along so sweet. And anytime you engage with her and she's not happy, she'll ruin the night. And there was so much sorrow there. And he said, it's just so hard for me to do these things you're talking about regarding setting limits on her. Because I just feel like I'm giving up on my marriage. And I said, yeah, what you want is to be working on creating a lot of positivity in your marriage. But what you're going to first have in order to get back over here is to learn to be somewhat of a warrior in your marriage. In other words, we're never going to, what does a repentant person need to grow? They need grace and love and tenderness and all that kind of stuff. What does an unrepentant person need? They need to become a repentant person, right? And that usually happens by them running up against the cost of what they're doing. So I said, you are wanting a marriage of warmth, and we're going to have to get there. We can get there. Like I say on the difficult people talk, it works like 90% of the time. Not 100%, but not 50%. 90% of the time it works. If you are a loving, godly warrior, living like Christ-likeness and power with her, she will start to bend the knee, because most people who are that toxic are really very frail. They're very vulnerable. So I want to set limits on them. So I would initially talk to that spouse or that coworker or that whatever about what are you going to say when they say, so all of our friends are going to Paris. Why aren't you taking me to Paris? And that's how you greet me when I walk in the door. And he can tell me, I can't believe she's so demanding. And I'm like, what'd you say? And he said, I said, well, I just don't think financially we were. I'm like, in other words, you played. I want you to say, you know what? Do you really want to talk about Paris? Make her say yes. I'll tell you where I am about Paris. I would love to take you to Paris. And I would love for us to have a relationship that was the kind of relationship of a couple who would want to go to Paris together. But I think you and I both know that our relationship is not there now. So many times I beg you to talk with me about healing and growth and all of that, and you just kind of mock me, and I feel that pull me away. So that's why I don't want to take you to Paris, but I want to work toward it. Do you want to? And if she goes, oh my gosh, you're so stupid. Cool. Say, well, I'm really glad I didn't engage you about Paris. In other words, I want to remain in this position of truthfully engaging her. Remember I said, unrepentant people, you lead with truth. This is this truth. So someone who says, I have this person who acts like this, my first person does to me. And I want them to become godly warriors who learn how to speak back the truth in a loving, powerful way. And it really does work. It surprises me. All right. Now, you talk about the forgiveness deal. One of the things I say in the forgiveness talk is that another thing I see hook Christians up is that we're called to forgive and we're called to forgive and we're called to turn their cheek and we're called to forgive 70 times 7. But that's with repentant people. By definition, folks, forgiveness refers to restoring and forgiving an event that has taken place in the past. You can't forgive an ongoing action. And I have so many clients who are like, oh my gosh, I just feel so bad about myself because I can't forgive my husband because he yells at me all the time and I can't forgive him. I'm like, oh my, when's the last time it happened? And she said, oh, this morning. And they're trying to forgive something that's still happening? That's impossible. That's not called forgiveness. That's called permission. You know, thank you, sir. May I have another? All right? In other words, the first step for that forgiver is to make this a behavior that took place in the past, if you get my drift. In other words, we go back to the limit setting, and I want you to know that when you engage me about, what are you thinking parking the car like that? I'm not going to play, and if you mock me for setting limits on you, I'm going to pull away from you, not because I want to punish you or because it's silent treatment, but because that's what tends to happen when people are hurtful and caustic, is they tend to lose people. And then, you know what? The jerky spouse is going to say, oh, by the way, the jerky spouse who just mocked me, oh, by the way, remember that office party's Friday night? And now what 99.102% of the victim people in my life who are like, why is this person so mean to me? What they will say is, okay, well, what time? And I want them to say, you know, I'm a little confused. Because the last interaction we had, you called me a name that John Cotts can't repeat in a church. And so I'm wondering why you think I might want to go to the office party with you. And send him to the office party by himself and let him explain why you're not there. Instead of paying the debt, paying the co-signing on this note of you can treat me any way you want and I'm still going to be available. I tell these people, you let yourself live like water. I want you to be wine. Think about water. We pour it out. We go to the bathroom. We wash our cars with it. We don't care about it. It's everywhere. That's you. Be wine. Wine, we're like, oh, this is a Cabernet, 750 milliliters. I'm going to pour it and taste it. Why? Because it's rare, all right? I want you to, you'll be treated as poorly as you permit. So if you're willing to go to the office party with the person who just called you names and treated you like that, then you are helping them be hurtful. That harms you, and it prevents them from ever having to come to Jesus or get humble or repentant. And bend the knee, and everybody falls down. Much less you'll never be able to forgive them because the behavior's still going on. And then guess who feels guilty for that? You, for not forgiving them, which is ironic because they're the bad guy, and you're the one feeling guilty because you're not forgiving the habitual bad person. What? Kooky, right? So is that getting towards your question?
Yes,
and. Oh, no.
Okay, yes, all that.
Okay.
I love it.
Okay.
Times 5 years.
Huh?
Times that for 5 years. And let's say not a spouse, because that's a whole different...
Wait, they've been acting with John Cox kung fu skills for 5 years.
Yes, and they're tired.
Yeah.
And the world has told them, and the church has told them, you should be nice. You should be sweet. You should be their friend no matter what. Jesus said, turn the other cheek. Or you're just stuck and going, I don't know what to do. I feel trapped. I just feel like there are people that I talk to, and I've felt this way myself, I'm sure. Just when do you say, I call it? You know, I don't want to call it if it's a member of my church. Mm-hmm. I don't want to call it if it's a close friend or a family member. But what is that discernment between I'm doing this, I'm holding, I'm not letting them get away with it, and I am on the floor exhausted? Does that
exhausted from what?
From holding the line.
Okay.
That holding the line, it takes
a lot
of energy.
So what you're saying is this whole thing works 90% of the time. This is the 10%.
Yeah, I guess so.
So first thing I would do is I want to do a full review of how they're intervening, because I just want to make sure I can't find any chinks, holes in the bucket. We need to fill this bucket with water, and if there are holes in it, it's going to be running. I want to fill the bucket. And there are people who are the 10%. Now, what give up means is I think that, I mean, in destructive, abusive, deeply harmful relationships, we do, I mean, even the Bible calls us to disciplinary separations at first easy. That's why Jesus said treat them like Gentiles or tax collectors. Disciplinary separations are legit. Ultimately, pulling away from somebody emotionally in a sense of saying, I need to guard my heart against how you treat me. And that means I'm going to be around you as little as possible. And I have to take care more of my own soul than engaging you. And that means what the line might be is I walk in the room and still after 5 years of intervention, they look at you and go, you're ugly. You go, you know what? I don't even hear you anymore. I'm going to call some friends. And you have to go to, in the worst case scenario, to care for yourself. All right, let's do one more question. 12:30 is when we stop, right? All right.
All right. Well, hopefully it won't take you too long to answer. But my question is about the sadness and grief.
Good. It's my favorite topic.
Okay. So if there's something that we legitimately need and it's a proper need that's not being met, I can see how we would be sad or grieve over that. But you mentioned as well Adam and Eve seeing the fruit.
Yeah.
And in reality, that fruit is going to kill them or cause death.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, is sadness really the proper response to something that we know is going to kill us?
Oh, cool. What would be another response?
I think after a lot of maturity and things like that, we might respond as, wow, God, you're really wise and you're righteous, and I want to honor you in that and submit to your design.
I know that my big square could do that. My little square would have trouble. Because my little square, he's a bonehead. And he, in his fallenness, shoot, we didn't even talk about sin. Crud. One of the most interesting things about sin is it is that our hearts are inclined downhill. You know, like the second law of thermodynamics, that if you, all you got to do to kill your car is not do anything to it for 2 years and it will not run. Human hearts tend to run downhill. It's easier to spend money than it is to make money. It's easier to gain weight than it is to lose weight. We tend to run downhill, and we tend to be that way in our souls as well. It's easier to blame somebody than it is to take responsibility. It's easier to lie when I'm in trouble than tell the truth. We are, what fallenness means is deeper than I did that naughty thing. It's that my heart likes badness. What did C.S. Lewis say? Creatures like us who find love and forgiveness as difficult as giving up things like beer and tobacco. our hearts like what's bad. So the grieving toward sanctification means taking into account the fact that it really will be sad for my fallen, broken heart to not get that tasty goody, the lust of the flesh and the pride of life and the, you know, that will be sad. So I like to have a category for that because it helps us get beyond our longing for it. Shoot, guys, I'd go on all day. This is fun. Y'all are such a good group. Thank you. Let me close this in prayer. Father, we worship you and we thank you. There is no truth and grace and hope and growth apart from you as the source of it. We are conduits. We are stewards of the manifold grace of God. We ask, and I pray on behalf of these people, you have blessed this church with your presence in such a rich way. I ask on behalf of these people that your spirit, that you just influx and flow inside of this place, as they continue to seek your heart and seek what it looks like to be together and be yours. Thank you, Lord. We love you. Amen.